We are going to talk cycling right now with Phil Cogan. Hi, Phil.
Hi, thanks for having me in.
We're going to talk cycling in a film you've just produced and is released.
When you say just, you mean
not just,
it's 5 years.
Oh, it's just been released.
Just been released.
It's hard
but
work.
There was no real just with any of the making, okay. The riding or any of it.
Now we're going to talk about this.
Yeah.
It's called Le Ride.
Yes.
And it's a journey all around France replicating the 1928 Tour de France.
Yes.
On a 1928 couple of bikes.
Yes.
First question, why on earth would you do this?
That's a really good question. I'm not really sure I have a very good answer. I think the primary motivation is I found this book about a New Zealand rider that I'd never heard of who rode in the Tour de France. He was the first New Zealand rider to ride in the Tour de France and part of the first English-speaking team. And as a cycling enthusiast and someone who loves Tour de France history, it was sort of shocking to me that I did not know his name. I did not know what happened. I did not know anything about him. And I read the book in one sitting. I picked it up at Auckland Airport on a flight back to Los Angeles. It was written by the Kennett brothers, and it said, Harry Watson, first New Zealander to ride in the Tour de France. And I thought, this is outrageous that I don't know who he is. And I'm a big cycling fan, and if I'm a big cycling fan and don't know who he is, how many other New Zealanders don't know who he is? And what he set out to do with these three Australians was so audacious and bold and groundbreaking. This story needs to find an audience. People need to be told about this. Little did I know that there was very little out there about what actually happened.
Okay. So if we put this into context, we're talking 25 years after the first Tour de France. We know there hasn't been Tour de France road during the First World War. So we are talking the very, very beginning of the Tour de France. And those guys came all the way from down here in New Zealand, all the way to France, 5 weeks on a boat. It's a crazy idea.
It's a crazy idea. But here's the part that, as I dug into the story, I started to realize was so unique and interesting about this. As audacious as it was for them to travel those 5 weeks on a ship with one set of rollers that they were sharing between them to try to keep fit on the boat, it occurred to me that so many New Zealanders and Australians were fighting in World War I in France 10 years before they got on the boat to go ride in the Tour de France. And the French people embraced the diggers, the New Zealanders and Australians. And anybody who's a New Zealander or Australian has relatives who were in World War I. I lost relatives in Gallipoli and at Chunuk Bair. I had a great uncle who was killed on the Somme, hit by a shell. I had another great uncle who went over the wall at Le Quinoa, the French town in northern France. So the French people embraced these underdogs who came over 10 years later because it was fresh in their memory what these Anzacs had done for them to push the Germans out of France. And so while the press wrote them off in the beginning because they thought, who are these people? How, you know, don't they know that they're riding against Nicolas Franz and the best riders in the world? Yeah. You know, they're going to come
Europeans,
over here.
All the Europeans.
All the European guys who were so amazing. And over a period of time, these Australians won over not just the French public. They were there with them. They were supporting them. They were out with Australian flags supporting them because of their sacrifice that they made in World War I. But they also slowly won over the press. And then Henri de Grange, who had created the Tour de France in the first place.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And we can see it's not just by the result they had. It's also by the sheer effort and the sheer determination they did show all across the stages.
Yeah, what they set out to do was just ridiculous. And they were meant to get six French riders when they arrived in Paris so they could be a proper team of 10 because the teams were 10. And the sponsorship didn't work out. Whatever happened, they found themselves as just four guys. And in 1928, 15 of the 22 stages were team time trials. And so the press just said, well, you can't have four guys go up against teams of 10 when you have Alcyon, you have all these amazing teams with the strongest riders in the world who have all these domestiques who are going to work for them. That's crazy. And even if they survive through the first eight stages, which are relatively flat. As soon as they get to the Pyrenees, because in those days they stuck with that schedule of literally circumnavigating France, how are they going to survive the mountains? How are they going to get over the death stage? You know, they'll be so exhausted by then they won't make it. And just before the tour, there was a race. I think it was the Paris-Brest race. And Sir Hubert Opperman finished third in that race. And I think a lot of the French riders and some of the French sports directors, they thought, wow, this guy really knows how to ride a bike. And so when they realized that there were just four guys, they came to Sir Hubert Opperman and they said, how about you join the team? It was Alcyon who offered him a position. He would have been working for Nicolas Franz. And Sir Hubert Opperman said, no, not unless you could take all of us. Mm-hmm. Now, they would have taken Harry Watson, who was very close to Opperman in terms of ability. But when he found out that they couldn't take all of him, he said, we're going to ride as a team. And so it was just absolute guts and determination that got them through those first eight stages to the mountains.
If we talk about your journey, how hard was it to find, first of all, a friend to do it? I think probably not too hard because you've got one crazy friend with you. But in terms of the equipment as well, finding a 1928 bike and everything else, was it kind of difficult?
Yeah, it was very difficult to find the equipment. I wanted to ride the exact brand of bicycle that they rode. They were sponsored by Rava, the Rava Wonder Bike, a French company. And you have to understand, when they arrived in the beginning, they were actually put in a camp with the French Olympic team, cycling team, just outside of Paris. And when these French riders saw the bikes that these guys from Australasia were riding, they kind of laughed at them because they had bigger balloon tires. The technology was not anywhere as good as the European technology. And so this company, Rava, sponsored them, and I wanted to make sure that I rode the bike. Now, in an ideal world, I went in search of trying to find Harry Watson's bike. I searched everywhere. We still can't find the bike. But I found the same brand, and it was a guy who is a collector, and he lives 5 miles south of Paris. And over a period of 2 years, I negotiated with him to get this bicycle. I even asked him if I could just borrow the bicycle and I would give it back to him. But I think he thought that I wanted the bicycle as a collector and I was going to sell it. So he said, if you want the bike, you have to come and see me. So I literally flew to Paris and I drove to see him. And he wanted to look in my eyes to see if what I was telling him was really true. Was I really, like, this is a crazy idea? He wanted to see if I was crazy or if I was serious. So I think once he realized that I had come all the way, mm-hmm. and that I really wasn't pulling the wool over his eyes, he embraced the spirit of the Tour de France like so many French people do, which is something that, coming from France, you understand it's a passion that is like the All Blacks in New Zealand. I mean, it is such a deep-rooted passion. And he could see that I was serious. And in the end, it was almost like he wanted to just give me the bicycle because of what I was taking on. He really believed in telling this story. But of course, I did pay him. And he understood that I wasn't just going to sell the bike. I will never sell the bike. I promised him I would never sell the bike. The bike is now hanging on my ceiling. I hope never to ride it again. But he embraced what we were doing. And then once I had the bike, the problem then was just ensuring that the bike was strong enough for us to actually make it the 5,500 kilometers around France. So we had to do a lot of work on the bike. I had to rebuild the whole bottom bracket and the bearings, and I had to change the crank length. The bike was too small for me, so I had to create a new seat post to shift my position forward to get some kind of power. But then that pushed the front out, and it had a terrible rake on these old bikes. They're terrible to handle. I remember the first mile I rode it, I thought, this is just ridiculous. This is crazy. But by that stage, I'd already made such a fuss about I was going to ride the bike. I couldn't very well go back to a modern bicycle.
And you knew you had 3,000 and plus to do on top of that.
Oh, yeah, the 3,338 miles, whatever that is in kilometers, and 150 miles average a day, so like 240 kilometers average a day. I mean, what these guys did in those days was, it's beyond comprehension.
Absolutely.
It's beyond comprehension.
I was going to say it's a proper Tour de France, but when you look at the map, yeah. Properly touring France. There's no area they're missing.
No.
They're not cutting in halfway through. Or...
No. I mean, the longest Tour de France in history was 1926. The second longest, I believe, was 1928. 1928, the year we rode, had the highest attrition rate, the most number of riders drop out of any Tour de France in history. And Henri de Grange, who created the Tour de France, as he said, you know, my goal is to have one rider make it back to Paris. Mm-hmm. That's a good Tour de France. So he deliberately made it a race of attrition where he would just wipe people out, you know, stage by stage. It was such a different mindset. And even when derailleurs came in the late 20s, early 30s, a rider said, you know, Henri de Grange, well, why can't we ride with the derailleurs? And he said, derailleurs are for people over 46 years old.
Mm-hmm.
When I wrote it, I was actually 46 years old. And I remember at one point I said to my friend Ben, I said, man.
Does that mean you can have one?
We should have been able to have a derailleur. But he didn't embrace new technology. He was very old school. And as you know, famous, you know, there was the famous riders who called him a masochist at the top of the Tourmalet when I think it was, 1910, going up over the top of the Tourmalet, which I believe is the most used mountain in Tour de France history.
Absolutely, in the Pyrenees.
Yeah, in the Pyrenees.
Do you look back at his journey and go, gosh, I've done it? Or you must be proud of the whole journey from dream to arriving at the Parc des Princes.
Yes, I am proud. The thing I'm most proud of is we set out to make this film without any funding, without anybody having a say in how we cut the story. It took so long to do, 5 years, because it was self-funded, and we refused to cut any corners in the production. You know, we shot this in 4K. It was the first documentary shot with a Sony 4K camera. I had no idea that I thought the hardest part of all of this would be writing, mm-hmm. but the hardest part of all of this was actually finishing the film. It just kept going on and on and on. We had about 54 drafts of the script, and we kept finding new pieces of information that we wanted to incorporate into the piece. We were paranoid that we were going to find some photographs or some images that we forgot to put into the piece. But the thing I'm most proud of, and I think my dad sort of summed it up for me, is the idea that we have ensured, whether people like the film or they don't like the film, we've ensured that the story, with everything that we believe is out there, that the story has been captured for all time, that there's less chance of it now just dissipating off into the ether. And my favorite sporting event is the Tour de France. And the fact that Australia and New Zealand is a part of it in this way is very special, but it was never celebrated. We have helped to ensure that this important piece of Tour de France history has been kept alive. And we have a special connection with it as people who come from New Zealand and Australia.
And so much of focus is given these days about how many English-speaking riders are in the Tour de France. Thinking those four guys were the first one is almost incredible.
Well, when I was watching the Tour de France in 2013, and I understand you were there.
We could have met.
Yeah, we could have met. I started the day that the Tour de France ended on the Champs-Élysées. That's the day that I decided we would start.
I was there.
And you were there. I wish you'd turn up to be a little bit of a crowd for us, because we had nobody turn up for us. We were just on the street where they started the tour.
I would have come. Nobody around.
But, you know, we really wanted to tell this story, and we felt it was important that we do it and that we share it and that we complete it. But I don't think we ever realized just how crazy it was that what we were setting out to do, because my bike broke as soon as I got past the Arc de Triomphe. Mm-hmm. My stem broke. I rode the bike with a piece of lighting equipment holding my bike together.
Actually, while you're there, what did you think at that time? Because I thought, 5 miles, you go, whoa.
Okay. Not even 5 miles. It was like 1 mile from the start.
And we had
150 miles to do that day, so 240-something kilometers. And I thought, this is just ridiculous. Like, it's sort of that thing like, never cry wolf, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, well, there's no turning back now. But about halfway through, when we got to the death stage, there was a day that took us 23 and a half hours. And I was hallucinating and seeing all kinds of crazy things. And I remember thinking, wow, if I went off the edge and it fell, everything we had put, all the hard work that we'd put into doing that at that point would all be lost because of some little fall on the ground and I'd break my collarbone or something and I wouldn't be able to finish. So it was only really then, and maybe it's because I'm not very bright, but it was only then that I sort of realized, this is a little nuts what we're trying to do here. Like, we have no safety net.
Yeah.
And when the film played in Christchurch, my hometown, We had 900 people packed into this theater in my hometown, which has been hit by a terrible Absolutely. Earthquake, and they've rebuilt this one theater. It's the pride of Christchurch. And my wife and producing partner, she's Australian, I turned to her and I said, wow, I hope they like it, because there's 900 people sitting here and only 5 people in the world have seen the film so far. And I suddenly started to worry that maybe people wouldn't like it. thankfully, people did respond to the film. And my dad said, you know, regardless of what happens to the film after that, just that one night, having that one showing with Harry Watson's family in the theater and being in your hometown, back where it all started, where this story started, this you cannot forget.
Okay, you answered my question. You have been able to talk to the family of Watson.
Yeah, and you know, what was interesting was how little they knew. I spoke to his son, who was born when Harry Watson was in France. Tears welled up in his eyes when I showed him.
Is the reason why he came back? Because you said that.
Yes.
Well, I'm not going to diverge the whole thing, but
because his wife was pregnant, and he had tears in his eyes because he realized he knew nothing of what his father had accomplished. I showed him photographs of his dad in French the Lemura magazines. And he saw photographs of his dad, and he knew none of it, because his father, typical, you know, New Zealand, Australian kind of mentality, you don't show off, you don't skite. So he never told anybody what happened or what went down. And so it was very sad. It was very frustrating, too, because I thought I would get more information from the family. Oh, he told us about this, or let me show you this, or let me show you that. So it was also very sad at the same time as being knowing that we were helping to keep this alive, I was also very sad that he didn't know more, that he couldn't give us more.
And the sad thing as well is that they passed away not so long ago.
Right.
So it's sort of a missed opportunity to actually have a recollection with them.
Yes, and that is one of the reasons why we decided to ride. Because in a typical Ken Burns documentary style, where you would tell the story with all the pieces and you would tell the story from the outside, and here, let me tell you a great story. We realized that we didn't have the subjects to sit down and say, you know, Sir Hubert Opperman, when you lined up against the best writers in the world in Paris, what was that like? How were you feeling? Take us back to that moment.
Yeah, was there any banter? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And when we realized that we didn't have that, that was part of the motivation to say, okay, maybe if we put ourselves in the film, in the story, and tell the story from inside the story, retracing every mile and going through every town and feeling what it was like physically and mentally for them, it will allow the audience to have a better understanding of what happened. Mm-hmm. That was the creative choice, which was a huge risk, because it juxtaposing 1928 and 2013, It's not a typical documentary style. Again, normally you tell it from the outside. We were telling it from the inside. Mm-hmm. So the trick was trying to find the balance of not making this about us, making it about them, but that we could share through the audience how hard it was for them, because they could see how hard it was for us.
Absolutely.
That was the tricky balance. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we got it right, but it was a very tricky balance.
I really, really enjoyed it. It took me back to France, and I really enjoyed to see.
Well, what a country you come from. I mean, we put extra effort into getting those aerials in the Pyrenees and the Alps. And the French people in the small towns, they're so inviting wherever you go. You know, they love this Tour de France. Again, it's a passion. It's so amazing, to be in a town when the Tour de France comes through. What happens to the town is so invigorating. And just for a brief moment to be a part of that. And as someone wrote about the film, they said, you know, whether you're a Francophile or whether you're a Tour de France enthusiast, my wife calls the film a love letter to France. Because how spectacular does the country look? It's
Absolutely.
Incredible with the sunflowers and the trees and the mountains, and it's so beautiful.
I'll tell you one thing as well, is that, you know, when you go and try the absinthe?
Yes.
I had exactly or pretty much the same experience when I do the Tour de France. I went to Vaison-la-Romaine.
Yes.
Wanted to interview the mayor, and they called him on his mobile. He's going to come. And then he realized I was from Australia. French guy living in Australia.
Yeah.
He called his brother, and then they came in with wine and food, and I ended up, I wanted a 5-10 minute interview.
Yeah.
I ended up spending 3 hours with them.
Yeah.
I had a full buffet, food, wine, everything, just because I came, I'm a French guy that lives in Melbourne.
But that is the, that is the passion, that is the passion of the French, their love of people and their passion for living. And that was in Pontarlier. And the mayor was on vacation, heard we were coming in, mm-hmm. brought us a beautiful gift, which I have in my kitchen. It's like a prized gift, and wanted to share this moment with us and with all his friends, and gave us this wonderful, warm welcome yeah. in the town. And there was a woman that was living there who was helping us with the research. And she, for months, did all this work to help us find, pull all the clippings from around France from 1928, from all the archives, because she worked in archives in Pontarlier. And she dug up all this information, kept feeding it to us as we were going around France.
Yeah.
And Angenot, which is a French lens company, and in my opinion, they make the best zoom lenses in the world. They have a passion for the Tour de France. They found out what we were doing. So they lent us about 400,000 euros worth of lenses.
Okay.
And said, please, use these lenses to tell this beautiful Tour de France story. And you know, when you're a self-funded film and you have somebody like Angenot come and help you like that, and you realize you have a huge responsibility, not only to make sure the lenses don't get damaged, but also to tell a story and treat it with respect, because there's so much respect for the Tour de France. So anything aligned with the Tour de France, you must give it uttermost respect.
Absolutely. We're going to finish on this. Phil, it was a real pleasure talking to
yeah.
you. The film is called The Ride, and it's currently showing at the Acme ACMI. The website is acmi.net.au. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.